So I'm the patient from University of Maryland and Joint Quantum Institute. Today I'm going to talk about our recent work probing the topological properties from the ground state wave function. So we all know that topological phase are the phase of matter that cannot be easily characterized by the local order parameters, and the phase transition does not follow the symmetry breaking and the Landau paradigm. Although there is no local order parameter, we still have a lot of interesting physical properties can observe. For example, from the macroscopic point of view, the ground state are degenerate, and the degeneracy depends on the topology of the manifold, things like that. And then if we put the system on the torus, we can perform those modular transformation to get it to see the idea, the Berry phase that will give you the anionic statistics. And for a microscopic point of view, topological orders are corresponds to some pattern of long-range entanglement, and excitation has some fractional statistics. And therefore, there are a lot of interesting observable that we can use to characterize a topological order. But these observables are non-local, and they're robust against any kind of small and local deformation of the Hamiltonian. So they're not easy to observe. So in this talk, I'm going to present our work to probe these topological properties, and especially just from the ground state wave function. So why do we care about probing the topological property from the ground state wave function itself? We have two motivations. And first, from a more fundamental perspective, we know that by definition, if we say the two wave functions are in the same phase, it means that these two wave functions, psi one and psi two, can transform to each other by a constant depth circuit. This statement actually implies that the ground state wave function by itself actually contains enough information to fully characterize the phase. Specifically for topological order, this ground state wave function should contain all the topological properties such as anionic statistic, quantum dimension, things like that, in order to fully characterize this topological order. Therefore, it means that we don't actually need to know any information from the Hamiltonian. We don't need to do any perturbation, any linear response, and measure the response from the perturbation. So one of the most famous example is the total quantum dimension. So it can be measured through the entanglement entropy. Usually the entanglement entropy by itself follows the area law because the interactions are local. However, in the topological ordered phase, it not only follows the area law, there is also a constant offset that coming from a long range entanglement. It gives you the topological quantum dimension. So that was the first motivation from a more fundamental perspective. And for the
sorry, can I ask a very fundamental question here? Is sure. It easy to see? They claim that because you can convert from one state to another within the same phase with a constant depth circuit, therefore you can actually find out some information about the order?
No, it's not that straightforward, but it should, this wave function should contain all the information to characterize a phase, but it doesn't mean it's easy to find.
And the wave function, the fact that the wave function contains the information doesn't mean that we can physically observe it.
Sometimes
because we don't have information about the wave function, just having the physical system.
Yeah, that's right. So we also need to find a way to we need to find a observable or find a measurement protocol to do that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that actually is related. This question actually related to my second motivation. The second motivation is from the quantum simulation perspective. Because we know the recently there are a lot of interesting developments in the quantum computers and the quantum simulators. So in this quantum computer and simulators, we have the luxury to directly access the wave function. For example, I can just perform the projective measurements on all the qubits in this system. And then what we get is some kind of equal time multipartite correlation function. So this kind of measurement is very different from the traditional condensed matter physics, where we can do probably like the linear response theory. We drive the system with laser, we drive the system with some AC and DC currents to see what's the response. So now it's a completely different kind of measurement. We measure the equal time multipartite correlation function. So with this new kind of measurement set up, of course, we want to develop a new measurement protocol to characterize the topological phase of matter. So the outline of this talk is like this. So first, I will talk about how to extract the Wilson loop operators and the fractional statistics from the ground state wave function. And the second part of the talk will be about the measurement of many body chain number on the ground state wave function itself. And if we have time, I will talk about how to do the our experimental proposal using the randomized measurements. So first, about the Wilson loop operator. Wilson loop operator are the string-like operator that can be used to manipulate anyon. For example, if you have an open Wilson loop operators, you can map the ground state to excited state. And this excited state contains the anyon and anti-anyon at the boundary of this string. And now if you have a closed Wilson loop operators, and this closed loop happens to wrap around a non-contractible cycle, and this can it can map the ground state to from one to another. And in the topological quantum computation language, it means that we have logical operations. And of course, you can braid the two Wilson loop operators and then see what's the braiding statistics of it. It corresponds to the mutual statistic of the anyons. And finally, we can create and exchange a pair of identical anyons. And this process corresponds to a measurement of spin of a certain anyon. So in this work, we are interested in the following questions. So given a wave function with a topological order, and how do we extract the Wilson loop operators from it? For example, let's say I have a wave function in my computer, and then we propose a numerical optimization scheme to learn how the Wilson loop operator should be like. And with this numerical scheme, after we get this Wilson loop operator, we can think about how to manipulate the anyon. We can create two anyons. We can move those anyon or annihilate it. And more importantly, we can measure the mutual statistic and self statistic in order to fully characterize the topological order. And this work, we collaborate with Mason, is a professor in University of Maryland and also in the Condensed Matter Theory Center, and also my advisor, Mohama. So the motivation of doing this, again, is twofold. Fundamentally, we can use it to characterize the topological order. And from the quantum simulation perspective, we know that the real world is not perfect. Let's say I prepare a Tori code in a quantum computer, but my quantum simulator is noisy. Then how do we manipulate anyon in this kind of noisy wave function? We probably still need to learn it in some sense. So in this work, we focus on the coherent error. So this kind of error will map the ground state wave function to another wave function, but it's still a pure state. So one of the most famous example will be like the torico in a magnetic field. So the first two terms are the usual torico stabilizer operators. This is a star operator and also the Plaquette operators. And in addition to this, we also add the magnetic field along the X and Z direction. When both the magnetic field are zero, we know what the Wilson loop operator looks like. This is a textbook problem. There are just some products of the Z operators and the X operators. But now if we turn on the magnetic field, this system becomes a not exactly solvable model. And there are some non-zero correlation length in this system. Someone raised a hand.
Yeah, it's me.
Yeah.
Ramon Laflamme. You say you focus on coherent error. Are these the error when you evolve the state or error when you prepare the state?
Good question. So this is we're thinking about like the when we prepare the state and the rotation is not perfect. So you can still reach a pure state and it probably still has a topological order, but now it's not a perfect story code.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Yeah, so maybe this model is too simple, but yeah, this is the one of the starting points. Of course, we can make some random magnetic field and things like that. But when in the presence of this magnetic field, the Wilson loop operator becomes a non-trivial operator in the sense that the thickness becomes larger and larger. And in principle, this thickness can go to infinity. But in this work, Hessing and Wen, they showed that we can actually approximate and truncate the thickness to some finite width. And this finite width just needs to be comparable with the correlation length of the system. And the error goes down exponentially with the thickness. So we still have some sort of string operators. It's just like a ribbon. So with this wave function in hand, how do we extract the Wilson loop operator from it? We first conjecture a Wilson loop operator ansatz. It's parametrized by some variable, let's say theta. And then the input is just the wave function itself and the ansatz we make up. And the output will be the older Wilson loop operator allowing the full characterization of the,
Hi, sorry, yeah, I had a question. So when you say the input is the wave function, what do you mean? Like, is it a classical representation of the wave function or like you're given the quantum state?
Yes, so currently we have the classical representation of a quantum wave function. For example, you can use a tensor network to find a ground state wave function and then send it to this numerical scheme. But yes, this can be generalized to a more quantum simulator way. So it would be like you have a lot of measurement data and you use those measurement data to find what's a Wilson loop operator.
Thanks.
Yeah.
A follow-up question. Is this classical description noiseless or noisy?
So in this example, it will be so as I said before, it's a torical model in a magnetic field. So in this, I would say it's noisy if my goal is to prepare an ideal torical, right? So those magnetic fields are noisy, but you can also think of it as an ideal in the sense that you have this model and the ground state is exactly this.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this numerical scheme is pretty general. When I say input is wave function, it could be the classical representation of it. It could be the measurement result. But at least it needs to be some kind of information of the wave function itself. And then Wilson loop operator ANSAS, this is also pretty general. You can parametrize it with some unitary gauge. You can parametrize it with some tensor network. Yeah, so for this example, what we specifically do is that I input a wave function in the infinite PEPS representation. And then the Wilson loop operator is like a matrix product operators. So you can evaluate those observable very efficiently. Okay, so how do we optimize the Wilson loop operator in order to make sure that it's a valid Wilson loop operators? What we do is that we use the following properties. If you have a closed Wilson loop operator, when you apply this closed Wilson loop operator on the bulk of wave function, nothing is going to happen. You create anion and then annihilate it. So the net effect is nothing. So we use this as our numerical optimization to make sure that this is like this equation is valid. So we can show that this can be mapped to a cost function. If you satisfy this cost function when C equals to zero, you can satisfy this property. Otherwise, the C will always be greater than zero. So with this, we can perform the gradient descent optimization to find the global minimum of this Wilson loop operator. Once we find the global minimum, it corresponds to a valid Wilson loop operators, and then we can use it to manipulate the anions. So after the numerical optimization, let's suppose that I get all the possible Wilson loop operators. And then I would like to manipulate anions, and more importantly, I would like to measure the braiding statistics from it. For example, here, the way to measure the mutual braiding statistics or the coefficient of the modulo S matrix, what you can do is to because what we have is like a matrix product operator. So we can easily twist the order of these two to make a twist in the middle, and this actually corresponds to the two anion braiding with each other and then annihilate with itself. So the net effect will be a phase. That phase corresponds to the mutual statistics. And then with this kind of matrix product operator form, we can also easily create a pair of anion. We just need to discard a part of the loop. And then what we have is now an open Wilson loop operator. And we can also move anion. How? So we start with a Wilson loop operator with open string. In this form, you have an anion in the boundary. And then we just parametrize another ANSAS to connect all of them and then re-optimize the whole things again to get a look back. And then we cut it in the different places. The net effect will be moving the anions. And then we can also use this re-optimization trick to merge anion. So let's say I have two anions, they are close to each other. If they are not close to each other, you can move it to make it close to each other. And then again, you just make another loop and then re-optimize it and then cut it again. So what you have now is a merged anion in the middle. So with this creation, moving, and annihilation, we can now talk about how to do the self-braiding statistic. So the idea of having the self-braiding statistics is actually from the is actually by just exchanging the identical particle, because there is a spin statistics theory telling you that when you exchange a particle, it actually corresponds to the spin. So we start with a loop, and then we cut it open. What we have now is a pair of anions, and then I flip the orientation of this two. Then I use the scheme we have previously. We know how to move the anion. We know how to merge the anion. So in the end, we can have this kind of twisted loop operators to measure the spin of the anion. So let's go back to the torical model with the magnetic field. So numerically, what we do is that we first use the infinite PEPs to find the and do the corner transfer meshes or renormalization group in order to find the ground state of this PEPs. After finding the ground state of it, we can use the numerical scheme I mentioned before to find the Wilson loop operators. And those are the braiding statistic and the self statistic of it. And overall, the number is correct up to maybe 10%, 20% to 30% error. Yeah, but it's pretty close to what we want. And now the more interesting thing is about the error of this Wilson loop operators. Because as I said in the beginning, when the system has a finite correlation length, the Wilson loop operator becomes a ribbon operator. It has a finite thickness. So we always need to make some truncation on this finite thickness. And then as I tune up the magnetic field, the correlation length actually goes up. And when we go to a phase transition point, the correlation length becomes infinity. But we are kind of away from that point because at that point we don't know what to measure, right? There is no Wilson loop operators anymore. But yeah, so with the finite magnetic field, you can see that the cost function we can reach is always getting bigger and bigger. It means that we cannot find a nice Wilson loop anymore. But and then so we measure the error of this Wilson loop operator as a function of inverse of the correlation length. And we see a very nice exponential decay following from the bound proposed by Hastings and Wen. And when the number of sites on this Wilson loop operator increases, we also see a very nice linear scaling with the error. Yeah, so this is the first part of the story. We also have a lot of different systems such as a double semion model and other different string net model. But here we only show you the easiest one, the torical model in a magnetic field.
Hi, I was wondering if you have to impose some like constraint to avoid like just finding a trivial stabilizer in the scheme. Like, do you have to enforce that it's a loop here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in this numerical scheme, what we do is that we add another turn to make sure that I won't be able to repeat the findings, meaning that I can sort of define orthogonalities and the distance between this Wilson loop operators and put it in the cost function. So if I want to avoid finding the identity operator, let's say, I just add another term which corresponds to a distance between Wilson loop operator and identity operators. So I give the penalties for identity operator, and therefore I won't find the identity operator as a global minimum anymore.
But for like stabilizer, I mean, would you have to impose penalties on like all sorts of combinations of local stabilizer or?
So when you say local stabilizer, you mean this A operators?
Sure, yeah.
But if we have the like a magnetic field, this stabilizer is not a good operator anymore. When you apply this A operator on the wave function, it's not going to give you one anymore.
What if there's like a dressed version that approximately gives you one?
The dress.
I think it's B operator itself is a, like a small Wilson loop operator. So finding it is not a bad thing, I think. And because B is like
a zero. I see. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Actually, I also have a question. So, yeah, so I vaguely remember that there was a paper, I think it was by Jacob Bridgman and Flamier Polan, where they studied ribbon operator by using MPS. And then I think they did some kind of optimization to study.
That's right.
Yeah. Is there any relation to that work?
Yeah. So the most distinct part between that thing is that the cost function they use is the commutator with the Hamiltonian. So they assume this Wilson loop operator is still a symmetry in your Hamiltonian. But here our goal again is to find, you probe the topological invariance just from the wave function itself.
I see. And another question is like, so here the goal is to find a string operator with like tensor network representations. So, but if I have, let's say, non-abelian anions, then ribbon operator usually look very complicated, right? I mean, it's still, do you expect that still works or? Sorry, I can't phrase my question more. So I think ribbon operator for non-abelian anion is not like a XXXX. It's not that simple. Like you do something and so on. So such complicated thing can be, do you think, studied with this method?
Yeah, so in our matrix product operator, what we can tune is the bound dimension, mm-hmm. and also the thickness of this Wilson loop operators. So I think when you increase the bound dimension to high enough, you should be able to see those operators. Yeah, but we haven't really find the. So one of the easiest example will probably be the. Let's say the string net model, there's a Fibonacci, right? Mm-hmm. In that model, if I remember correctly, in the analytically solvable part, if you want to write down the Wilson loop operator as a matrix product operator, the bound dimension is actually huge. It's like 20 something if you do it analytically. So the numerical optimization part will be very difficult. Yeah.
And sorry, one more question. So you let's say, that's subject two. you have a expression of string operator for this part of the toric body, and then is it something obvious to like? Should I just cut it And that's one question. And another question is like given. Tensor network representation of string operator, is it easy to implement it? Like, is there any, it's an operator, but we might not know how to implement it.
Yeah, that's a good question. So so for the first one, if you just cut it, of course this bound is kind of, you also need to find a boundary condition to contract this bound, right? There's something, and what we find is that it doesn't matter what kind of boundary condition you use, just don't use zero, use one at some point, it should be fine, because what you will change is more or less like the shape of this anion itself in the boundary, but this doesn't actually affect changes the statistic or everything. For example, I change something here, the operator locally over here will be very different, right? But when I calculate the braiding statistic or something else, I can always choose an operator that cross this part, cross the very middle part of this Wilson loop operator, so that the braiding statistic is not trivial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for another question, you are right. If I just have a matrix product operator, how do I implement this in the, you're saying like in the experiment or?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's difficult actually. So in the future, what we want to do is that instead of parametrize the Wilson loop operator in the matrix product operator form, it should be like a unitary ansatz. So so here I try to make the scheme very general. So I say there's a wave function and there's a Wilson loop operator, but I don't actually specify what they are, right? Because you can change the form of it to make your goal easier.
I see. Yeah, thanks.
Excuse me, another question. So here you represent the wave function by tensor network, but suppose the wave function is represented in some other form, like say a Parton wave function.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this method is still feasible?
Yes, so in this numerical scheme, you just need to know how to evaluate these cost functions. So this cost function, if you look at it carefully, the first term is just an expectation value of something, right? And minus one and take the square. And the second term, again, is an expectation value of something, but it's easier. You just apply this operator on the wave function itself. So as long as you can do these things efficiently, you can evaluate the cost function efficiently. So for example, you said a Parton, you probably can do it, right? Or using Monte Carlo or other trick.
Uh-huh, okay, thanks.
So, I probably won't be able to go through all this story of the second part. But I will try to give the first part of the story. So here our goal is to measure the many body chain number from the ground state wave function itself. So in the first part of the story, we use a topological field theory to transform the original measurement scheme, such as flux insertion and polarization measurement, things like that, to equal time correlation function. So just measuring some certain equal time correlation functions, you can extract this trend number from it. And the second part of the story is that we collaborate with Peter Zoller's group in University of Innsbruck, to show that, okay, how do we measure this kind of equal time correlation function in the real content simulators? Okay, so about fractional quantum Hall effects. Fractional quantum effect has been discovered in 1970s. What it is that they have a two-dimensional semiconductors under a very strong magnetic field. And what this is that the whole conductance is quantized to some integer or some certain fraction. And Laughlin gave a very elegant argument to explain why the whole conductance needs to be quantized or needs to be a fraction. So let's say I have a two-dimensional electronics wave function on a torus like this. And the magnetic field goes outward directly from this wave function. Now, if we apply a magnetic flux along the y direction and then change the flux from 0 to 2 pi, due to a gauge invariance, what we'll see is that the ground state will return to itself if there is no ground state degeneracy. And therefore, the net effect will be like you have some integer charge transport around this circle. And the number of charge transport through the circles is just the Chen number in a modern language. However, if there is a ground state degeneracy, the wave function could probably go from one to another during this flux insertion. So the generalized version will be requiring you to apply more than one flux. So now, if we want to monitor the progress of this flux insertion, what we do is to measure the polarization operators in this torus. So what's a polarization operators? In the open boundary condition, it's very straightforward. We just measure the Y operators. But in the periodic boundary condition, we need to revise our definition. This has been done in 1988, called the Restas polarization operators. You just put this Y on top of the exponential, such that when you add the Y by L, it still give you the same numbers. So with this periodic polarization operators, we can monitor the progress of flux insertion. If I do the flux insertion from 0 to 2 pi, what you will see is that a certain number of charge that goes around the circle, and therefore you will have some integer windings. And in the end, it should go back to 1 or 0 because the wave function should return to itself. And this winding number corresponds to a Chen number. So, but in this story, there are two things we don't like. First, we don't like the periodic boundary condition because in the quantum simulator, there is no periodic boundary condition at all. Everything's local. Another thing we don't like is that this flux insertion process, because it changes the wave function. And the goal here is to measure something by just the wave function itself, right? So we don't want to couple it to some EM field and then change that EM field because it will change the ground state wave function. So the claim here is that we can synthesize the flux insertion and the plus the polarization measurement without the periodic boundary condition and without the flux insertion. So what we need to do is to just measure the equal time correlation function. To get to how the things work, let me just give you a very brief review on how do you do the space-time surgery for TQFT. So let's say I have I have a one-dimensional system, and then I want to evaluate this observables, where the V operator applies on the region 1 over here and the region 2 over here, and the W operator and its conjugates applies only on the region 1. But the most interesting part is that we have this swap operation that swap the matter fields in the region 1 and region 3. But make the region 2 invariant. Okay, so with this kind of setup, it can be shown that you can measure some topological invariant for SPT phase in a one-dimensional space. So we can reinterpret this measurement in the topological field theory. So let's say in the topological field theory, this wave function in the one dimension becomes a 1+1-dimensional manifold with a one-dimensional boundary, something like this over here. And its conjugate apparently is gonna be something like here. And this W operator can be interpreted as some symmetry defects that we will talk about later. And V operator is also some symmetry defect that applies under both region 1 and the region 2. So this is what we have in the TQFT language. And the nice thing about TQFT is that you can arbitrarily continuously deform your space-time to make whatever you want. As long as everything is continuous, the partition function should give you the same result. So now we contract this loop and this loop over here, so we can go from here to here. But we need to know that the swap operator do is that we need to contract this part to this part, and also contract this part to this part. So in order to visualize how it works, we make a pi rotation for the second hole over here. So what we have now is this. And then with this setup, we can very easily contract the this two space. What we do is to just to extend the region over here and here is like a longer things, and then glue them together. In the end, what we will get is like a space-time torus over here. So, okay, maybe let me just recap what I say. So by evaluating this kind of observable, what exactly we have from the topological field theory point of view is that we synthesize a space-time torus by just measuring some equal time correlation function. In this sense, we don't actually need a periodic boundary condition anymore because in the open boundary condition, we can synthesize a periodic boundary condition. Another nice thing is that, as you can see here, the loop operator goes around the non-contractable loop. So you can actually associate this loop operator as our twisted boundary condition. And another red one can be associated to the polarization measurements. So we actually have everything we need. Remember in the original Laughlin's argument, what we need to have is a flux insertion and the polarization measurements, right? Here, and also periodic boundary condition. We need these three things. So in this new picture, we have periodic boundary condition because of the swap operators. We also have the flux insertion operator. Originally, it was a periodic boundary condition, and then you change your twist boundary condition, right? But now it becomes an operator acting on the wave function. So again, this is an equal time correlation function things. And the polarization measurement remains the same. It's always like an equal time correlation function. So the net effect of this story is that originally we need to do flux insertion through a torus and measure what the charge transport in the torus, but now everything can be done in the plane. And the flux insertion can be done by just applying some operator. The polarization measurement is also just some operator. Everything becomes in the equal time correlation functions. So this kind of setup makes it easier to simulate in the quantum simulator. And also fundamentally, it answers the question like, can we probe a chain number just from one wave function itself? Yes, we can do it. This is the answer. So in order to prove that it works in the TQFT language, but we also need to know if it works in the lattice model, because in the quantum simulator, everything is like in a lattice. So we perform the DMRG simulation with matrix product state. We simulate a couple of different models, including the bosonic fractional quantum Hall effect with filling fraction 1/2, and the bosonic bilayer fractional quantum Hall effect, and also the bosonic integer quantum Hall effect. And of course, we have fermionic things like the usual integer quantum Hall, and also the Morrow-Reed state with a non-abelian statistic. We also can see that both of them works. So this is what we have. Oh, sorry. So this part is what I said in the beginning. But now we can, in order to perform the measurements in a quantum simulator, we realize that this kind of equal time correlation function cannot be efficiently measured in the NISQ device. So we make another topologically equivalent version of it with two copies of wave function. It looks more scary, right? But this one can actually be easier to be measured in the experimental setup. So I think I'm not going to go through the detail of the experimental measurement part because we probably are out of time. So let me just directly go to the summary probably. So the summary of the second part of the story is that using a topological field theory, we show that the measurement of the many body chain number can be done by just measuring some equal time correlation function that involves the swap operation. And the swap operation is useful to synthesize the periodic boundary condition. And therefore, it means that the chain number can actually be measured without any kind of linear response, without the periodic boundary condition, without the flux insertion. Yeah, so yeah, that's the second part of the story. So in conclusion, the what I present today is like a new direction to measure the topological invariant from just the wave function itself. And it's very useful in the current quantum simulator setup. Yeah, I think that's it.
Okay. Let's thank the speaker. So we have actually 10 more minutes. So if you want, you can actually go through the experiment part. I think because I will definitely ask about it.
Okay. So
I was going to ask also about the experiment.
Yeah. So okay. So for the experiment, you can of course you can do this thing by just you just do the full quantum state tomography. You may literally measure the four wave function, and then you can calculate this observable. But that's not efficient, right? It's not what we want to do. And for the right hand side, this formula. Let me explain what we have here. We have two wave functions and they are identical. They are both a fractional quantum whole wave function, okay? And then I apply this, again, the polarization and the flux insertion operators in the region one of the, region one is like here, or the color is a little bit confusing. The region one of wave function A and the region two of wave function A. And now the swap operators is like you do the transverse swap. So you have wave function A and B, right? You just think of it as like a two decoupled layers. And the swap operator is gonna be swap the field in certain region, in region one transversely, and in region three transversely. That's what we have, okay? And this kind of operation, if you remove those W and the V operator, what you're gonna have is actually the Rene entanglement entropy. Because the Rene entanglement entropy can be written as a swap operator acting on the tensor product of two density matrix. So this measurement, we're going to propose over here will be very similar to the measurement of the Rene entanglement entropy, the second order entanglement entropy, like trace of rho square. And what people have done before is like they literally prepare two copies of this, the same system. This is a Bose, if I remember correctly, it's a Bose-Hubbard models, and then they measure the swap operation by doing some tunneling, and then you can use it to measure the purity of the system, which is trace of rho square. But another way to do it is that you don't actually need to prepare two of them. Instead, you just prepare one of them and then just do the randomized measurements. Because when you perform random unitary on the state you have, And then do projective measurement. What you have is, let's say it's called PU of S. P means the like the probability distribution of the configuration of this measurement after applying a random unitary U, okay? And then it can be shown that the statistical correlation of this random unitary can give you a swap operation. The intuition is like you, when you average over a lot of random things, what you have is either the identity or permutations, right? So you just do the second order of it. What you will have is the second order permutation, which is a swap operation. So the experiment becomes a lot easier now. What you need to do is that you prepare certain state and then just perform the random unitary, then do the projective measurements, repeat this a lot of times by just calculating the average or second order moments of average, you can have the Rene entanglement entropy, like the trace of rho square. So
can I ask a question? So in this case, the good thing is that even though we need to keep performing the measurement, but we only need to prepare one copy. Is that so? Yeah. I see.
That's right. So originally,
is it more? Comparing two methods, like preparing two copies and do the actual measurement of Rene entropy, or doing this randomized measurement,
the cost
in what sense? And
that's a very good question. So for this one, the cost will be a lot fewer than the randomized measurement, because this actually, in the end, you probably just need to measure one qubit or something. You can do control swap and just measure the control qubits. That would be just a one qubit measurement. But here for a randomized measurement, because you apply a lot of different random unitary, the subtlety is that how many random unitary do you need in order to have a converged result? Yeah, that actually scales like 1/√(n). Where n is the Hilbert space size. Yeah, so it's like a central limit theory. Yeah. Yeah, so the scaling is actually not that good, but it's still fine in the current measurement regime.
I see, but if it's in a situation where it's difficult to prepare two identical copies, like I have a state, protocol ordered, but slightly different, but each time this method may be better, I guess, or I don't know.
You mean you can, if you prepare two of them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know in what situation this would happen, but maybe.
Yeah, so for one-dimensional system, it's possible, like what they do in 2050. So, but for two-dimensional system, if you want to prepare two of them, and then do the swap operation, this kind of technique is very difficult. Yeah, right. in the current experiment setup. Yeah.
I have one more question, but I think Ray wants to ask a question.
I was worried about the scaling. So you said what it goes like √(n), not 1/√(n), right?
Sorry. 1/√(n).
So how many qubits do you need to do something? What's the minimal number of qubits you need to do something interesting?
Yeah, so for fractional quantum hole, of course, you need to have something that is bigger than magnetic length, correlation length, something like that, right? So I did a simulation and we found that the number of qubits is around 40 something, 48, that would be enough. Yeah, so for current system, for example, Google has maybe 50 something, IBM have 128. So it's kind of in this regime. And in terms of the measurements, actually there are two costs. One is the number of random unitary you need. Another one is how many times you need to do the measurement in order to remove the shot noise. Yeah, but short noise, I mean, what we want is a real probability distribution, but every time you just measure it shot by shot, so it's not going to be a continuous thing. Hillary.
Hang on, let me get my mic working. About doing multi-copy implementations, mm-hmm. when you do the swap thing, one of the big problems that occurs with those when you're doing them in practice is that you really, really need to have a clean tensor product. If you've got any classical correlations between the copies or there's any entanglement between them, when you do the swap, the measurement can lie to you arbitrarily badly. And there was a paper by Stephen Van Enck from a few years ago. I was trying to find it for you, but it's certainly earlier than 2018, in which he explains this and demonstrates with the explicit examples how a separable state can apparently, because this technique was developed years ago for doing entanglement measures, nonlinear entanglement measures. You just have multiple copies and you swap the indices around and you do the trace and yada yada, right? And that gives you an entanglement measure. And all that kind of went fat after Stephen Van Enck and I think maybe some other guys as well pointed out that if you have correlations between the copies, when you do the permutations, it will lie to you arbitrarily badly. And Stephen Van Enck included an explicit example in his paper. The other thing about the other comment I wanted to make is when you're talking about having to do these higher order moment approximations and measurements using randomized measurements. Has anyone said the phrase T-design to you? Because there's some mathematical machinery which is designed to help with that problem. Have you read the literature on that?
Yeah, so I haven't gone through the math part of it. For T-design, I know that for 2-design, you can do it with Clifford. 3-design, you probably can also do it with Clifford, but not more than that. Yeah, we haven't used 3-design, so I haven't gone through much of it.
But you know they exist, and you know.
Yeah, actually, so when we say this random unitary measurements, we need to ensure that this is a 2-design, because otherwise it's not going to work.
And otherwise, it won't give you the second moment that you're looking for, right? That's kind of the point about 2-designs, is doing fully randomized measurements is actually really hard. But 2-designs are a method where you can come up with a simpler set of measurements, a finite set of measurements that will allow you to match the moments up as far as you want to go. So a 2-design will match the second moment, 3-design, third moment, 4-design, right? As far as you need to go. Right. Yeah, so if you're trying to optimize a circuit to solve that particular problem, there's the mathematical machinery for that, which might be handy.
Yeah. So in reality, what we observe is that you just need to do some random circuit, and then the T design actually depends on the circuit depth. If you want to go to higher T, you need to have a longer circuit depth.
Yeah.
So again, so it's more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the machinery that I'm telling you about does, is handles that. So you might find that if you're having trouble with that problem, you know, go dig into that literature, you might find somebody else has already done it.
I see. Thank you.
Right. You're welcome.
Any other question? Actually, you are still in the middle of your... Yes. Did you already... We asked a question in the middle of your explanation, and I was wondering, I think you were explaining the experimental implementations.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much it. The idea is there. So just do a randomized measurement. Oh, and also, those operators can be easily implemented because they are just some density operators. Those are single qubits rotation. So, yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
Right. Okay. That's actually the right time. So so thanks. And do we have any other questions?
Yeah, I have one more question. Hi, great talk. Thanks for the talk. So I was wondering, do you have to worry about any of this like spurious topological entanglement entropy that can exist in ground states that like does your method see that ever?
So we don't measure the topological entanglement entropy here, but yeah, we do see some spurious other things. It's like when we measure the Wilson loop operators, actually what we found is that there are some trivial states, and then if you put that to the numerical scheme, you can still get some kind of Wilson loop operator that shows some non-trivial braiding statistics, but those are a very fine-tuned model with a gapless Hamiltonian.
Do you find modular data for more general theories with boundary? Does that or does it sort of rely on like a very unlucky situation where you happen to compute the Wilson loop exactly where that so I would imagine it would be very unlikely to happen that you find the this like lower codimension excitation. But I also don't know what you're putting in necessarily, like whether your tensor network ansatzes might have those contributions or whether we might expect they don't exist, try to prove they don't exist.
I'm not sure actually. Maybe they exist, but we haven't seen this kind of
So where you said you see some spurious things? Could you maybe elaborate on that a little bit? Like in what setting?
Yeah, so that's a gapless model, and in that model you can fine-tune your Hamiltonian such that the toric-coat model, you can think of the ground state as a linear combination of all the loop with the equal coefficient, right? Mm-hmm. But now you can tune this coefficient such that the coefficient exponentially decay with the perimeter length of all the loop as a loop operators. This kind of wave function, actually, if you put it in this numerical scheme, you can still find the Wilson loop operators, but this is not a topological ordered phase, because when this exponential factor goes up to infinity, of course, what you have is a spin polarized state. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that model is very spatial, very fine-tuned situation. And that's the parent Hamiltonian corresponds to a gapless model. So mm-hmm. so that's a very again the spurious and but that's a very interesting direction, and it probably means that actually recently there's a new paper saying that you cannot fully characterize the topological order by just measuring the linear observable. This is from John Preskill in Caltech. They proposed this theory. So we are actually thinking about the relation with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Oh, great. Thank you. And thanks again for the talk.
Any other question?
Well, it's not really a question. I've just put the references I was mentioning in the chat. I also tried to look up T-design stuff for you. There's a whole bunch of stuff. It's a very active field of research. I suggest you go fishing.
But I assume that he knows these things because it's very standard on them.
Right. Well, yeah, that's why I was surprised that the phrase T-design did not appear in his talk.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good. So I have one more quick question. So yeah, it's actually like going back to this Kitaev-Hannikov model, for instance, do you think your method improves some of the results what like this Jacob and others did? The reason is because actually like people are really, I think, obsessed with creating that model experimentally, right? Both on material and also on code atoms. So I wonder like your method maybe actually very good to numerically or even experimentally detect topological order in these models.
You mean the Kitaev model, like Hannikov model with
Hannikov model, right. Model. Yeah.
I suppose you're talking about the phase in the middle where you have the non-obedient phase, right?
Yeah, maybe both. It could be both. But even like in the Abelian phase, I think people want to create it, right? I mean,
Yeah, that's why.
Actual material.
I'm wondering,
like,
I guess it, again, it probably still depends on the correlation length and all kind of, how many parameters do you need in order to have a Wilson loop operator. If it's small enough that my classical computer can handle, then we can probably find it. Yeah.
Thanks. That's all from me. And I guess we have asked too many questions, but yeah, let's thank the speaker. And yeah, thanks for the great talk.